So Chris, before we dove into this conversation, and ladies and gentlemen, you'll realize that we're going to be talking with Scott Mautz, and he wrote this incredible book called Leading from the Middle, a playbook for managers to influence up, down, and across the organization. But before we even started, Chris, you asked me, so who's this guy and what did he write? Because, you know, of course, sometimes we arrange these things, you're not exactly sure. And so, but let me ask you this. Now, after listening to this conversation, do you kind of get it? Do you understand?
Oh, yeah, totally get it. I mean, and the things he was talking about, it's middle management, you know, and how a lot of people feel about it. It's totally our organization and many others, I'm sure, as well as schools. So, yeah.
I mean, you will see.
Brilliant guy.
Brilliant, right? I mean, it's. I mean, this was actually a long podcast. I mean, we try to time these things as best we can, but I could have gone on and on and on and ended up talking right through my other meeting I had scheduled after. Just because.
Well, I mean, it's hard when they keep giving you good content. It's like you don't want to turn the faucet off. You just want to let it keep going.
Yeah,
so it's hard.
I could have kept going. In fact, it got to a point where I had to say, okay, let's talk about the second half of the book in a question, right? Because it was just. Anyway, there was, ladies and gentlemen, I really think you're going to like Scott. And even if you're just intrigued, we don't do this podcast to sell books, but you have to read this. It's my opinion. I'm going to be recommending this like I do some of my other favorites. So this is a big one. Ladies and gentlemen, enjoy our conversation with Scott. He is a rock star in the world of leadership. Be well. Ladies, gentlemen, educators, leaders, welcome to Leader Chat. I'm Jeff Rose, and I'm going to try to cut to the chase here because everyone, I don't know a person. Who for which this content is not going to be valuable for them. I don't. I mean, I clearly, as most know, as most of our listeners are in the educational space, our focus is leadership in education, which can mean lots of things. We have many superintendents all the way down through principals and beyond who engage with us and are part of the leadership circle. And I still don't know a person who should not read and listen to this information. So I was thrilled when I read this book maybe 4 months ago or so. I put this name early on the top of our list, and I said, I have to reach out to this person. So thankful that he was able to join us. And we are going to be talking with Scott Mautz. Now, Scott is the author of several books. We are going to be focusing on Leading from the Middle, a playbook for managers to influence up, down, and across the organization. And for our members who are watching this via video, you'll see I have highlighted bent pages. I mean, I have, you know, the hockey sticks out of this book is, it is an absolute mess because I loved it so much. And so coming up with the content and the questions for Scott, especially since we recently chatted, was difficult and challenging because I could keep this guy for 4 hours. So. Scott Mautz is a high-octane speaker, expert at igniting peak performance and deep employee management, motivation, inspiration. He's a Procter & Gamble veteran who successfully ran several of the company's largest multi-billion-dollar businesses, an award-winning bestseller author, faculty at Indiana University Kelley School of Business for Executive Education, a former top Inc.com columnist, over 1 million monthly readers, and frequent national publication and podcast guest. And before I have Scott join us, as you may have noticed, we, of course, focus on educational leadership, and we have some rock star leaders to join us. In the meantime, we very strategically are looking outside of education because there is so much rich content that I believe educational leaders don't get enough of, and I feel it's our responsibility to try to bring it to them. So without further ado, Scott from San Diego, I believe. It's good to see you.
Great to be here, Jeff. You got a nice looking backdrop there. I always have a nice looking backdrop because I live in San Diego.
Because you live in San Diego, and like, and we know that we have members who are listening, watching video, but we also have a lot of people who listen to the podcast. And so, those that are not watching this via video, I want to be really clear. We have a great background. Scott has great hair that I want to tease him about because when I saw him the first time and we chatted, it didn't align exactly to the pictures and videos that I had seen as I was kind of sleuthing this guy. And I showed up and all of a sudden I'm jealous because I can't do what he does. So he's got this flow. It's like a San Diego flow. And I'm from Southern California, so I know it well. So
this is what happens when you let yourself go, Jeff. You just let the hair go and say, I'm going to be one with nature now. That's how it works.
You don't understand. See, that's what people like me dream of. I just don't have the ability. It has nothing to do with anything other than what, you know, what the good Lord gave me or didn't give me in my case. So anyway. So your bio, Scott, I can't, as you know, it's uncomfortable when people read your bio, right? So maybe just tell us more about yourself, and not just your background, but what has led you to do what you do now? And we're going to get into, of course, the book, Leading from the Middle, but kind of what is your why and your motivation? Help us understand what makes you tick a little bit.
Yeah, I've been doing what I do now, Jeff, for almost a decade, you know, as a speaker, an author, a writer, a workshopper, a trainer. And, you know, I could trace back what I'm doing now quite a long ways to, you know, when I was in the middle of my corporate life. And I know we have a lot of educators obviously listening and watching today, Jeff, but I think certainly they can also kind of line up with what I'm talking about when I say, you know, when I was in the middle of corporate America early on, I started to realize that, you know, maybe over the long haul, there's a lot of people that could use what I have to offer in a more broad and a more profound way than, you know, me just trying to sell 10% more soap than I did, you know, last year.
Yeah, right.
And it kind of started about halfway through my corporate career where I started looking around me and thinking, you know, I think I have a real burning desire in me to broaden my platform for making a difference. And I want to do it with a spoken and written word because, I don't know, somewhere along the line, somebody decided that, you know, maybe I'm not the worst in the world at either of those things. And I started paying attention to, you know, especially people in the middle management role. And we'll get into what I mean by that in a minute because, you know, we're all kind of middle managers by my definition. But, and we'll get into that in a second. But, you know, I did notice this untapped potential to help people that are in the middle of any organization, any organism, if you will, any living, breathing entity where you go in and you put so much of your heart, it's so much of your sweat, so much of your time in, that there is this big gaping knowledge gap. You know, we like to read a lot about people in the C-suite of an organization. We like to read about people that are in their first 90 days. And there's this big swath in the middle of people that are slugging it out every day in the center of an organization with a boss to report to, people to manage and peers to work with, that was largely underserved. And so the spark began years and years ago, Jeff, where I felt this sense of purpose to try to serve those people that ultimately have to lead in all directions in their organization to be able to do it well because they were so underserved. And I began watching and taking notes and learning from people who did it well and those who didn't, and trying to build up my knowledge base so that I could do what I'm doing today, which, you know, I hope has broadened my platform for making a difference for anybody that's in an organization of any size that wants to do their job a little bit better and become a little bit stronger at it.
So I'm trying to get, I'm now kind of, I have this window into some of your early motivation and what has led to what you do now. And I would agree, you're, whoever told you that you're good at this, they were right. And so, but when you were kind of in the seat, you know, you were in this organization, looking around and learning, you know, through other people as well as your own role. I'm going to make a statement and you just tell me if I'm right. What I notice in, you know, we like to put the leader, you know, we put a lot of people into the box of they are leaders. They have leadership roles, right? And so, however, people sometimes in that seat, even though they may have a kind of leader stamp on them, they don't always recognize themselves as leaders, and they become quickly doers. Right. So they're doing the work, and sometimes they're stellar at it, but not necessarily leveraging their full potential and capacity because they don't necessarily know some of the tools to lead, especially if they are not the leader, but they still have that leadership stamp. Were you watching some of this and thinking, wow, if these people that I'm working with only had more precise tools and wisdom and guidance that they could be more effective. Is that kind of what you were getting at?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, and I saw so many people, Jeff, that had a hard time drawing themselves to the connection and the association to being a leader. And, you know, there's been a lot of work done in this field, but, you know, if you want somebody to do something that you want them to do, there's two ways I could do this. Jeff, I could ask you, you know what, Jeff, you know, I would really like you in the future to take some leadership actions more often. Or I could say, hey, Jeff, I would really like you to play the role of a leader. Could you do that for me? Research shows that the more often that you focus on the identity versus the action that you're asking for, people are going to be more likely to do that. Wow. Yes, Jeff, thanks. Yeah, I do want to be a leader. I do want to be associated with that. I do want people to think of me as that identity, as a leader. And what I saw, you know, was so many people not willing to create the identity for themselves of leader. They got asked to take leadership actions all the time and had a hard time doing that. But when you could elevate them up to saying, no, you in fact are a leader. I expect that of you. I want that identity for you. It would change the game. They just, as you said, needed the tools to make it easier to accept and associate with that identity of leader. And that's when I realized I knew I was going to be onto something. If I could not just speak to this underserved audience, people in the middle of an organization, but if I could also provide them practical, pragmatic, proven tools that gave them the confidence to assume the identity of being a leader, I knew I'd be onto something. And I think that's where the book Leading from the Middle really started to blossom from there.
So let's spend some time talking about kind of what that means from the middle. I mean, as you described the up and down and across, you know, concept, and you know, you also very clear that it's messy work. But I think as you talk about it, others will also realize, okay, that's me. Because as I read it, I remember thinking the vast majority of people, whether they have the leadership stamp or title or not, are in this space, but maybe don't even know it. So can you spend some time describing this space and who this specifically was written for?
Yeah, you bet. Let's start with a term. And again, I know we're talking to educators here, but let's just kind of switch it and talk about the term middle management.
Yeah.
Right? Popular culture has turned it into an evil thing, right? We've all seen The Office with Michael Scott and the worst version of what middle management could be, a buffoon who can't get anything done. We've seen maybe the movie Office Space. And Jeff, I know you have a red stapler somewhere around your desk there, I know.
Huge fan. Huge fan.
Dilbert, the cartoon. So you get this popular social and cultural movement of middle management becomes a dirty word, and people don't even want to. No, I'm not a middle manager. I'm so much more than that. Step back and let me offer this definition. A middle manager is anyone who has to lead up to their boss or to their boss's boss, down to their employees, if they have them, that report to them, or across to peers, people over whom they have no formal authority, and must do all of that in some combination to be really, really good at their job. As you opened up by saying, Jeff, you know, this book is for everyone. I really do believe that's true because all educators essentially are in the middle. We all have somebody that we report to, whether it's a principal, whether it's a board. We all have peers, fellow teachers. We all have subordinates, if you're in an educational field, of course, the students or perhaps TAs. We all have, even CEOs have to report to the board. The thing is, Jeff, it's that dynamic of having to lead in every direction, up, down, and across, that makes this such a difficult space, rife with so many interesting dynamics, difficult dynamics. As I say in the book, there is no leadership challenge greater than the challenge of having to lead from the middle and do so successfully up to the boss, down to subordinates, across to peers. It's what lit my fire so intensely to want to provide content to help in this space.
So I assume, just the way that you kind of address that at times this concept of mental management is probably really misunderstood. I mean, so because you're right, it's the very reason I thought this is so relevant for people. So if you're a principal, for example, all of our principals who are engaged with us, they of course have to lead up. They have layers upon layers all the way up into the board and then the community, et cetera. And so even the superintendent, right? So they are the, quote, CEO of the organization, but still also the board and everyone underneath. And you're right, every principal has a lot of people that they're kind of answering to below them, which is, now I know that below sounds awkward, but, you know, the teachers and obviously the students and the community, et cetera. So it's just so relevant. So I just have to assume a lot of people go, whoa, and they bristle. Like I'm not in the middle. I'm a practitioner or I'm a leader. I'm not a middle guy. So am I right that people bristle at times and misunderstanding it?
That's right. It's why I open every keynote where I talk this topic in the book, Leading from the Middle. I open each keynote with a definition of, what do I mean by leading from the middle? What do I mean by middle manager? Yes, you are a middle manager. And I say it with love in my heart. And then I say, it's okay, because, and I give a number of statistics in the book about how important, statistically speaking now and data-driven wise, middle people in an organization are for the success of that organization. Just stat after stat after stat about the role that the middle layer of management plays in the success of an organization, more important than the role of a CEO or anybody in the C-suite. So that I also make sure the audience understands, it's okay to feel that you're a part of the middle, and you should be proud of that, because no one has an impact on any organization like someone who has to manage in all directions.
So as I was, I'm going to ask you about this, and it was hard for me to pull kind of this question together, because like I said, I had so many highlights and marks throughout the book. But, you know, as you're talking about this work too, you've early on described it as messy. You also really kind of empathize and show that it is exhausting, right? You talk about this micro switching, which I hope you mentioned, because I think it's really important. And it's amidst this pressure cooker environment. You also make this point that, and I love this, you don't work in an organization, but an organism. And I think that's really important for people to talk about. So just maybe talk to us about how your work also in doing it. It's your advice throughout the book, and I'll mention this over and over, so pragmatic. But maybe talk about those concepts of, you know, this micro switching and pressure cooker environment all the way into this concept of, you know, an organism, not an organization.
Yeah, in the book, I go through in detail about what makes the job of being in the middle of an organization so difficult. And a big part of it, Jeff, is, you know, what I call micro switching. It's the number of hats that as a middle manager that you have to wear, and how you're constantly micro switching. Here's what I mean by that. You might be in a role, you might be in a meeting, and all of a sudden, you know, you're playing the role of, okay, I'm in charge. I have to come across as in charge, and I have to come across as authoritative. And then maybe your boss steps into the meeting for a minute. All of a sudden, you got to switch gears and be more deferential to the boss because they come in. Then after the meeting is over, you have to switch gears and be collaborative with your peers. Then in the next meeting that you're in, you have to take on another role. You have to put on another hat and another hat. And we see this constant micro switching where you're going sometimes in the depth of one meeting, from having to be very deferential to the boss, to authoritative to people that report to you, to collaborative with peers. You can go from moments where you have complete autonomy, and in the next moment, you feel like you have no autonomy.
Yeah.
You can go from moments where you feel like you're making so much impact, and then the next moment, you feel like you're working on stuff that's inconsequential and there's no impact on that. And it's this constant micro switching over and over and over again for anybody who's in the center of the organization that must play to all the dynamics up, down, and across the organization that become, it can make it so tiring. And as you said, Jeff, it's why it's so important to remember that you work in an organism, not an organization. And within an organism, all the atoms and the stuff that floats around within an organism has to be very symbiotic. It has to flow. It has to go with the flow and understand that its job is to extend its amoebas and its corpuscles out to address whatever the organism requires for it to stay healthy. You can't be rigid when you work inside an organism. You can be when you work inside an organization, but you have no choice when you're in an organism because there's so many parts that need your attention to thrive. And we see in our research that the middle managers that understand that need to stretch and flow to the moment, to be able to micro switch often and to do it with pride and to not let it exhaust them. They're the middle managers that tend to really accelerate their careers.
You know, this word organism, it's at least the second time that I just remember hearing of it, but it stands out to me because we are reminded that the working with people, influencing people, regardless of what that is, right? Whether there's a Fortune 500 company, whether it is a school district. The first time I heard this concept was actually a pastor in a church telling the congregation on something that actually turned controversial. He said, "Let me be clear. We are the perfect mess. We are the perfect mess." Now, I believe we're perfect based upon what we're trying to lead. But in the meantime, it is messy because we are an organism trying to figure things out all the time with sometimes no clear answers, but we are doing the best we can. And so this concept of reminding people this is an organism is important because it doesn't always feel like an organization because it does get slippery all the time. And then you go from there to these 21 roles of a middle manager. I read and I thought, every single one sticks with me. I mean, yes, everyone. How did you get to the point, Scott, where you thought, I'm going to start making note, and you came up with 21, which is not an insignificant number, and they all are sticky. How did you do that?
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. And you know, you're talking about a section in the book I call Rock All Your Roles, you know, meaning anyone who lives in the middle of an organization, that micro switching is between a variety of roles you have to play. And over a 10-year period, I began noting the different roles that someone in the middle would have to play in codifying them, if you will, and then conducting in one point of, you know, research with over 3,000 middle manager executives to confirm that each of these roles are something they played and were a part of their everyday life. And I think of it as like a 21-gun salute, if you will, because just as luck would have it, I was able to identify 21 different roles that the majority of people who work in the middle of an organization would say, yeah, that's me. I need to do stuff like that. For example, I hear a lot about, hey, you got to be in the middle. You got to be a translator, meaning you got to take the strategies that come down from the education board, from your principal, from whoever you report to. You have to translate those strategies for people that you work with, sometimes perhaps for students, for coworkers, for anyone that you have in your line to say, okay, this is the strategy I've been given. Let me translate what that means for us. You're the one in the middle. If it doesn't happen with you, no one's going to do it. At the same time, you also have to play the role of what I call a converter. Just making sure everyone understands the strategies of the board isn't enough. You have to convert them into things that actually make sense, that people can process and take away and say, okay, I get it. That makes sense in my world. And you scrub out the language that might have come from on top when those you know, strategies and things were passed down to you. So you have to convert it to your audience in a way that they can process and do something with it. When you're in the middle, you have to play the role of strategist as well. And in the corporate world, at least, Jeff, what I can tell you, one of the biggest complaints that we heard in our research from middle managers was, you know, I just don't have time for strategy. I have too much stuff to do all day. I'm an executor, and I'm executor, and I'm executor. Except the middle managers that were ranked best by their group of bosses did see themselves as strategists in that if you don't come up with the strategies that are going to be the most powerful for the group affected, then who's going to come up with those? It can't just be people who live in an ivory tower passing them down. You also have to play the role of creating strategies, making sure they make sense for the school district, for your classroom, for the corporate room, for the team that you lead. You also have to make sure you're developing frontline strategies that also work. And on and on and on, you know, we go. So I identified the 21 different roles. And maybe the broader point here, Jeff, is it can be exhausting if you let yourself sit there and say, oh my gosh, he's right. I have to put on 21 different hats. Or you can flip it and take incredible pride in knowing that not a lot of people can switch in that many roles and do it well. And it's something to be proud of if you can take that on and do it well.
You see, that's how I saw it, Scott. When I read through those, I remember noting, you know, this should boost some esteem of people.
I hope so.
Because the concept here you are talking about how complicated from this code switching of kind of role constantly, that it is just not easy work. And so in my mind, it should build up the leader that you have a very difficult, challenging, complicated role. That's how I took it. And maybe it was kind of through the lens I read it through, but I think it did that really, really well.
Yeah, thanks for that. And it's in the book. It's meant to embrace and help. You know, I also give single piece of advice, you know, so if you're a translator, what's the single best piece of advice I can give translators? If you're a converter, you're playing that role that day. What's the single best piece of advice? So I also try to make it a lot, you know, empowering, Jeff, so that people aren't feeling overwhelmed. They acknowledge, yes, I do play a lot of roles. And I get advice on how to do those roles to the best of my ability. So that's the intent. That's what I was going for.
Well, I'm going to jump on a soapbox, but I'll quickly jump off. And so because this part of the book really, really slapped me around. In fact, it's something that I sometimes speak on. I was actually in San Diego recently speaking to a group, and I was talking about this very concept. And it is around servant leadership. Now, in education, servant leadership, we talk about it a lot, Scott. I mean, we talk about it a lot, but I was picking on it a little bit and said, I don't know if we should talk about it as much because educators, even as they kind of rise into leadership positions, are typically there because they want to serve others. I mean, if anything, we're good at that.
By default, yeah.
Yeah. If anything, we know that. That's our why. That drives us. In the meantime, I think we talk about it often because it truly makes us feel valued in our work, right? This is what we signed up for, and this is what our job is. However, I think at times we sometimes struggle from a leadership perspective on understanding how to put that into context about, you know, what serving actually looks like. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're running around constantly taking care of the needs of others. Sometimes you have to lead. And so the way that you put servant leadership into context, maybe it was one of my favorite parts. I loved it. So if you can kind of unwrap that a little bit, I think it's really important for educational leaders to hear about.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Jeff. And, you know, this is probably one of the parts of the book that has gotten the most buzz, maybe just a touch of controversy here and there because there are servant leadership purists out there. And, you know, of course, I understand that.
Yeah.
And what I talk about in the book, Jeff, is I try to debunk just a little bit, taking servant leadership wholesale, just consume it as it is, and that is the way to go. And I offer an alternative. But let me start by saying what I think is problematic with servant leadership in general. And I'll start by saying this, that kind of like you said, Jeff, it is very difficult to look at the intent behind servant leadership and have a problem with it. You want to serve others in a great capacity. That is hard to argue with, and that is a wonderful thing. And I still think it's a really big part of what we should think of as leaders. I think we should enter it, though, and I'll offer an alternative, a different tree on the branch of servant leadership in a second, if you will. But I want to point out first some of the issues with servant leadership that we've seen in our data and our research over the last 10 years. One of the problems with servant leadership, you know, starting with the presumption that the basis of the intent is good, as we've seen in our data, sometimes servant leaders can come across as a little bit too soft, not willing to do the tough things that need to be done for the organization, for the business, the broader business, whether it's the business of education, advancing education, or whether it's the business of selling more units than you did the prior year, or whether you're in a nonprofit and, you know, moving forward the business of your cause. Servant leaderships can come across as a little bit soft and not necessarily always willing to do the right things, and in some cases might not feel great for the organization and the people in it in the short term, but needs to be done over the long term. We've seen that servant leaders sometimes, one of the limitations is, they don't establish their authority and mastery as much as they should. As you said, Jeff, there are times when you need to not lead from behind.
Yeah.
You need to step up to the forefront and lead. The organization wants to see you at the forefront, like in times of crisis. Your bosses want to see you at the forefront, and they appreciate that you lead from behind and you prop up your organization and you're there to serve. But they also want to know that you have the strategic wherewithal and the chops to do your job from the front of an organization too. You know, we see sometimes with servant leaders that they can struggle with command and control type leaders, which might happen a lot in education. I don't know. I sure as heck know it happens a lot in the business world, because those servant leaders are very much like, okay, I understand what you're dictating to me to do. I'm just going to go translate that as a servant of you and not push back on things that might not even be right. We see, you know, one last thing with servant leaderships, we see that the energy can go quite often too much to everything is for the organization that I'm serving, the cause that I'm serving, and not stepping back often enough to think about, but is it the right thing for the organization over the long term? And so I offer in the book an alternative, what I call others-oriented leadership, which simply says, it's, and notice, others is the first word in it. It's still grounded and rooted in servant leadership. And it's about, the focus is off the self, but the focus is on others in all directions. Yes, you have to serve the people that report to you from behind. Yes. But you also have to serve the people above you that have their needs and have things that need to be met that might require you to do things that don't always feel servant leader-like, but that you have to do for the, you know, for to serve the needs of your boss. You have to do things that might help your peers out, but might not be best for your individual team or group or student. It's about creating, you know, others-oriented leadership is about creating a broader view of the world and understanding what you have to give, what you have to give up, what's a given and what you get for the broader common good, not just for the people that you're serving.
Well, for what it's worth, Scott, this concept, I mean, and I was unaware that, you know, you've experienced maybe even some level of pushback, but I can understand why. I mean, in my opinion, this is just my opinion here. I think that servant leadership is accurate. It's often our job to serve. And I also think that the concept of servant leadership also makes us feel good and feel value. And it justifies a lot of the things that we do. Yeah. I also recognize, though, even whether I read this or not, that sometimes too much focus on simply serving starts to pull away from one's ability to lead and to sometimes lead boldly. And the fact is, in all organizations and in education, we need bold, courageous leaders willing to take some risks. And sometimes that doesn't always feel good. And that's also sometimes okay. And so the fact is, I don't feel as though that part of the book was picking on servant leadership. I think it was putting into context. And actually, as you kind of made this shift to others, I think it really helps say that, no, this is a belief in, but it's making sure that it keeps it in the right place to help a person give strategy on probably when to code switch, right? Is when I kind of help, But sometimes, to your point, I got to step up.
Yeah, right? That's exactly right. And I'm very careful in the book, Jeff, to refer to others-oriented leadership as and servant leadership. They're branches of the same tree, and they're grounded in the right intent. It's just meant to help people who are servant leaders at heart, and they want to do the right thing for their people, which should be all of us, to just be more self-aware of some of the limitations of that approach when you're operating in an organism and not just in an organization. And that's what that section is intended to do. And I think it has for many people. It's helped them reframe a different way to think about servant leadership in a way that you could serve the intent and be an even better leader in so doing.
Well, I yanked it out of this dense book because I think we needed to talk about it. So just I think it's great. Now, in the meantime, you mentioned earlier that that the attempt was, and it was more than an attempt. It was great. That there's so much pragmatic advice given throughout the book. I mean, really, where you give something specific in terms of a strategy. You say, hey, this is what I recommend you consider. I mean, so I wrote down some notes here from this, AMPLIFY, which is an acronym, and you can talk about that. The perfect, the 50-50 rule. I loved it, by the way, the ninja skills needed, et cetera. I mean, there's so many sections. And so you can talk about those. And I also am curious, what do you find that sticks? Like, obviously, there's so much content there. What are you seeing as you go out and talk and engage and support organizations and individuals? What tends to be really sticky and helpful for people?
Yeah, first, I'll kind of talk to the approach of this book, Leading from the Middle, in all my books, including the next book that I have coming out. If you're looking for a summer beach read, don't pick up my book. And there are even within the business space, there are people that are incredible writers, like your Malcolm Gladwells, that'll have one mind-bending concept, perhaps, and they'll talk about it in depth, and it's fascinating. And my approach is to really dig deep and create indispensable guides with practical, pragmatic advice in each book. From a keynote perspective, I always say my pet peeve is the sugar rush speaker. They get off the stage and everybody has a sugar rush because they're inspired and they're excited, like, wow, that's really cool. Then the sugar rush crashes and they're like, so what am I supposed to do differently?
Yeah, yeah.
I never wanted to write a book like that. So I take longer than your average bear to write my business books because I put years and years of research into them, but also I pack it with pragmatic tools that have been proven with real teams across a variety of industries to show that these tools can work. So that's the nature of the book that you're talking about. And just to reference, there's one section in the book where I talk about an acronym, AMPLIFY, which is what we learned from our research. The best middle managers in the world, they act in a kind of a capacity of being an amplifier. And I talk through, each letter, what that means in more, kind of detail. A is, your adaptability. And, I won't go through each letter, but, the A in Amplify, for example, is we see over and over the best middle managers are incredibly adaptable. And I talk about the 50-50 tool that is really, I've heard a lot of feedback on, a lot of people use. And it's very simple, in a situation where you need to be adaptable. Remember the 50-50 rule, which is spend 50% of your time on pragmatic things, 50% of your time on possibility. And what that means is 50 plus 50 equals 100, which means there's 0% time left to be catastrophizing about the situation that you're in. You just have to adapt. How do you adapt? On pragmatic things to get to the next step, 50% on possibility, looking at the thing that you have to adapt to, the adversity you're facing as an opportunity. What's the possibility in this adversity? What's the agreeable adversity here? 50% pragmatic, what to do next, 50% possibility. How do we turn this into a positive? So I see a lot of people really grasping onto a lot of tools in the book. Another one that I've had I've lost count of the number of people that have written me about it. And one of the letters in Amplify also, Jeff, without going through all of them, is this idea of the L in Amplify of locking in.
Yeah.
And we see some of the best middle managers that get the highest ratings in their organizations. Their bosses describe this ability for the middle manager to lock in on the things in front of them that are important and to do it consistently with great effort over time in a way that they're able to avoid even burning out in their role. And so in the book, I give advice for how to address burnout. If you're the one that's suffering from it, if you're the one that sees an employee suffering from it, if you have a peer that you suspect. And it boils down to really answering four questions. And let's do it this way as an example for your audience, Jeff.
Okay.
Let's say I suspect you're starting to burn out with all the things that you do for Cognia. My gosh, you're a great podcast host, and you do this and you do that. But I'm starting to see signs of burnout from you that I talk about in the book. I would sit down with you and I would talk four questions. And I would ask you, Jeff, let's talk about first, is it too much work that's on your plate? That's the obvious one.
Okay.
It leads to discussions of prioritization. But the second question I would ask you is, Jeff, is it the wrong work? Are you focusing on things that have gotten outside of your job that you're not passionate about, that don't fit with the mission of the organization? The third thing I would ask you is, are you getting the wrong response to your work, Jeff? Because we see much of burnout comes when, despite your efforts, you're not getting the response that you had hoped for. You don't feel appreciated. People aren't taking you seriously. You're not seeing your work boil down to the bottom line and make an impact in the places you want it to. And the fourth question I would ask you is, you know, Jeff, do you have unrealistic expectations about your work? And then we talk about, you know, yes, I know you're going for the 100% all the time. And, you know, maybe there's wisps of perfectionism that start to eke in. And so I've gotten a lot of feedback that these four questions, is it too much work? Is it the wrong work? Are you getting the wrong response to your work? And do you have unrealistic expectations of your work? I get fed back that a lot amongst many of the other tools that are in the book.
And then, you know, people have to, of course, remind themselves that in this case, that maybe they're not talking to their therapist and they need to get off the couch, right? And actually, now, I would agree, Scott, that the book, it's not light. Right, it's not simply a rah rah book to get you excited. It is dense, which is probably why I love it so much and think it's so valuable, because it's concrete in a way. In the education space, that sometimes we don't talk about, we just assume that people can figure out. So yeah. You're taking this thing. These deep, challenging roles that we just hope people are good at and they will figure out along the way. And you're helping people understand the complexity. And then you're saying, and if you want to improve, this is how. And it is. It's extremely, extremely dense, which, by the way, congratulations. That's what is really, really helpful about it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jeff. I appreciate it. And, you know, I've learned over the years that if my goal is, and I've been lucky enough to see this a few times, maybe more than a few times, and even Jeff, when we were talking before this happened, I want to see people in the airport, and this happened recently, and I'm sitting next to somebody, and I look over, and I see someone with their nose buried in the cover of my book, and I also see about 15 sticky notes on the margins of the pages as well.
Yeah.
That's the kind of book that I try to write. I try to write indispensable guides that are a good read and an interesting read, but that force you to go back and say, man, there was a section on this part of being a middle manager. The whole chapter, for example, on how to lead my boss.
Oh, that's my next question. We got to talk about that.
Over and over again. And that's what I'm gunning for, it to be an indispensable guide, not a summer beach read.
Okay, so like I said, check, because you can look at my book. I'll show you someday. let's talk about leading your boss, because huge, huge section, really important to talk about, not talked about enough in organizations. And I can attest, and I've had lots of different positions, you know, up through superintendent a few times over, and there are a lot of bosses you always answer to, right? And so you know, then you have to figure out, how do I influence? How do I support? I hate to use this word, but sometimes even manipulate them a little bit to help them understand. So, but how do you lead your boss? Well, just unpack that for us, because people have to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter dedicated, because yep. Remembering leading from the middle, you know, I have a chapter that talks about leading up to your boss, leading, you know, and I use the term down only from a hierarchical standpoint, you know, coaching your employees, leading your employees, and then leading teams and leading your peers. And, you know, leading your boss is often overlooked. The fact that you have to have a relationship with your boss, of course, but there's so much more to that relationship to do it well. And I talk in the book about, you know, a couple of really important points of a model. I call it the managing up staircase, one step you take at a time. It starts with, you know, first of all, just understanding the nature of the relationship between the boss and his or her subordinate, which so many people miss, which is simply this, Jeff. Yeah, it starts by understanding your relationship with your boss is this. It is the interdependence between two imperfect human beings. And if you believe that, you're already off to a great start, because what that says is, I accept that my boss cannot, will not ever be perfect, but I accept that I need him or her. And where we see a lot of boss relationships with subordinates go wrong is when, you know, and we've all had bosses that are, you know, probably not that great. And what happens? We unplug from them when we say, I'm done.
Yeah.
I don't need to deal with that boss anymore. And I can guarantee you, your relationship is doomed from that point forward, because you're not acknowledging the relationship is an interdependence between two imperfect human beings. And notice I said two, not one, two imperfect human beings, which includes you. So you start from that. You know, then you go to just the importance of understanding the asks and understanding the expectations that are laid upon you, which aren't to be taken lightly. We did a separate piece of research that I called the FBI research, Jeff, because we invited over time now, this has been over years and years and years, at this point, almost 300 pairs of subordinates and bosses, and I talk about this in the book, into a room. And we put the boss into one room and the subordinate that works for him or her in the other room, so that they can't hear what the other person is saying. This is why I call it the FBI research. Then we ask the boss, what do you think your employee expects of you? And then we ask the employee, what do you think your boss expects from you? And we asked them a number of questions related to the expectation sets. And what we found over years, as many times as we've done this, Jeff, in over 80% of the cases, there are material breaches in the most basic understanding of expectations. And I say this with love. If you have employees that report to you, I guarantee you they are not as clear on what you expect from them as you think they are. And vice versa, you know, the odds are you probably don't really understand what your boss is expecting from you. So I talk about the importance of getting crystal clear on what's really expected, and that you can do it through a series of 9 very powerful proven questions that I won't go into here, but they're in the book. But it's the broader idea of getting clear on what's asked of you. You know, the next step in the model, I talk about, you know, just the importance of being aware of the boss's style, how they like to receive information, whether or not they're introverts or extroverts, whether or not they enjoy it when you stop into their office for drive-bys or not, the importance of understanding style. I go on to talk about when is the right time to get personal with the boss and get to know them. And it's actually not right up front, not till you've established that your house is in order, that you are really in control of the details of your job, that you can be trusted, that you're there to help them. And then you also have to, you know, the last step of the model I talk about is providing purposeful support, supporting your boss in the ways that they want to be supported, giving them the information when they need them, helping them make decisions, helping them to solve problems, helping increase their capacity, advocating for them if you feel like there's something worth advocating for. So it's a whole chapter dedicated to the strategies of being exceptionally effective at leading up to your manager, whoever he or she may be.
I have to assume, Scott, as you describe this, that this has got to be a chapter that you get a lot of feedback on. You know, I mean, we like you said, we all are in kind of answering to somebody, and at times we if we're answering to somebody, we receive their perspective, their guidance, their direction, et cetera, and we may have lots of different ways we think about those things. And then we try to act accordingly and either, you know, accept it and move it forward with fidelity or, you know, make some determinations on our own. But well, I'm gonna put this over on the side and you know, I'll get to it, but, you know, I don't see it as important, et cetera. So, but this advice that you give as it relates to this relationship between you and your supervisor is just really, really important. So I just have to assume that a lot of people say, gosh, I haven't thought of it that way.
I hear a lot of that, and it really, I guess the need for it was born out of, I remember probably, oh gosh, over 5 years ago when I was really in the heart of starting to do the core hard research for this book of, you know, Jeff, I just couldn't find a guide, a book anywhere that codified the process of how to lead your manager effectively. We all know we have to do it. We all know in our guts that, okay, I have to have a good relationship with my boss. You know, I have to figure out some ways to influence him or her. I have to figure out how to get along with them, or I'm going to leave the job. And we all know that's the number one reason people do leave their jobs is when they don't master this. And it was that absence of any help whatsoever that drove me to work so hard on this chapter. And that is the thing I hear back the most is that, wow, you gave me literally a step-by-step plan, because there are some steps you should take before others as you build that relationship with your boss. And that's the biggest thing I hear is just that no one had codified the process before. And I think I've been able to do it in a research-backed proven way.
Yeah. You know, then, and so for our listeners or our watchers, even though Scott and I have been talking for a little bit, and to remind people that the concept of the Leader Chat is to take some really impressive content or perspective and make it, you know, digestible in somebody's very busy life, right? And so, and yet Scott and I are maybe, even just we're summarizing, we're halfway, right? Because I think that through the book, if you look at the rest, they're really important concepts, right? The leading those that report to you, leading teams, leading change, huge concepts in these, you know, kind of your final chapters or kind of second half of the book. So kind of in summary, rather than try to summarize each chapter, knowing what's happening right now, because leadership is a little bit different now than it was a few years ago, right? Sure. I mean, we've witnessed some really interesting and challenging trends. So thinking about those environmental factors, from your perspective, where do you think if a leader is going to dive in and say, like, I'm going to dive into some of the steps, where do you think they start? I mean, other than starting at the beginning and ending, what do you think is the most strategic place for a leader in this day and age to dive into leading from the middle?
It's a terrific question, Jeff. And I'll speak to trends that we've seen in leadership. And I will be surprised, and I'm going to let you confirm, that you haven't seen these in education as well.
Okay.
You know, this book was written was published just as the pandemic was really in the middle of its thing. And since then, you know, me having talked to organizations all over the world over the last 3 years, we see an increasing need for empathy in the workplace as more and more of us go through the horrors of what the pandemic has done, as, you know, war has been reintroduced into our planet in a number of, you know, on very terrible ways, as we become more divided as a country. Some would argue that we can't even agree perhaps on what the facts are anymore. I don't know. But the need for empathy has arisen. The more that we become more remote in our organizational endeavors, that you know, more and more organizations have at least 2 days at home and then maybe 3 days in the office if you're lucky. And again, I know that's very, very different for the educational field, but we see the need for empathy greater than ever. We see the need for fortitude and resilience and perspective to come across some of the new level of difficulties that are introduced to our daily lives that has affected leadership. And with that in mind, you know, I would encourage the listener or watcher, as they pick up the book, Leading from the Middle, to start with two chapters in particular. Remember, this is a book about leading in all directions, leading up to your boss, down to the people that work for you, across to your peers. I would suggest starting with considering the people that report into you and their needs, being able to be fully enabled to coach them, especially in the world where we have less face-to-face time than we've ever had before, especially in the world where people are less confident and have lower self-esteem than in any time period since we've been measuring it as human beings. Start with really knowing what it takes to coach and to get the absolute best out of someone in an organization, number one. And then number two, and this may surprise you, Jeff, I don't know, I also have a chapter towards the end of the book on leading change, because as it turns out, there is no one in an organization better suited to lead change than someone who is in the middle of that organization. They are closest to the day-to-day impacts of what needs to change. They're closest to the to be able to translate changes handed down from on top and to smell what change is needed moving forward. And I have quite a bit of experience in the field of change management and an entire chapter in the book on how to lead change effectively from the middle of an organization, which I think is required more than ever because things are changing faster than ever. And you have to be able to do it in a way that actually accomplishes what you want it to, because we know that 70% of change initiatives fail and it's getting harder to lead change moving forward. And the chapter will help you to do it with brilliance.
Yeah, these things you're mentioning track, right? I mean, in the education space for sure. I mean, of course, you know, this political polarization that's happening is really difficult on the educational leader, right? And so, you know, at times, you know, an educational leader may have a real strong opinion themselves. And so what they sometimes need to remember is, wait a minute, my job is to sometimes listen and have empathy for even my boss or my board or this, you know, faction in my community. What are they truly saying? Where is this coming from? And how do I honor it to a degree? And trying to then get to a place where all leaders would say, yes, we need to change. But having the understanding on what is the right change and what, you know, leading which change will have the biggest impact in this day and age, that's a really, really challenging decision to make. And so that level of kind of wisdom for leaders is tricky. So what you just said tracks completely. Yeah. So that one thing we ask all of our, this is the one thing we do, Scott, where we give content to leaders. The majority of our processes is these roundtable, right? We say circles are better than rows. These processes where we bring people around the table to kind of tap the collective wisdom of each other in sometimes solving some very complicated and very nuanced educational problems. So if you and I were to pretend we're around a table and we have been talking with educational leaders, and we've had questions back and forth and discussion, but you realize, oh gosh, I've got to go, but I'm going to leave you with these final words of wisdom, things you may want to think about right now. What would be kind of your drop the mic moment? What would you want to tell people?
This one might surprise you, Jeff, but I would say chase authenticity. Don't chase approval. What we see in the business world, and I wonder if it can be the same in the educational world, is in this pursuit to become accepted, in the pursuit to excel in our careers, we can lose sight of the authentic version of ourselves, whether it's in the classroom, whether it's with a board, whether it's when you're in your office, an office with a principal, or you're trying to express your ideas and your concerns. We see over and over again this unhelpful, unproductive trend of people trying to chase approval rather than return to the authentic version of themselves. And my closing message in that scenario that you described would be, the world needs the authentic version of you and the unique qualities that you bring to the table. They don't need you trying to fit some presupposed mold that requires you to change who you genuinely and uniquely are.
Mic dropped. It's beautiful. Scott, when's your next book coming out? You said you're working on something?
Oh, yeah. Thanks for asking. It'll be coming out May 7th. It's called The Mentally Strong Leader. It's about one of the great superpowers of our time, you know, this idea of mental strength, the ability to self-regulate your emotions, your thoughts, your behaviors to achieve exceptional outcomes, even in the face of adversity. So, yeah, I'm very excited about it. And if listeners want to and viewers want to check that out, they can do so at my website, scottmautz.com. And they will find Leading from the Middle and my new book coming up, The Mentally Strong Leader.
And what we'll do is when we post this, we'll make sure to list some of these things. And then I'll just ask you, since we're recording, and this makes it tricky for you to say no, is it possible maybe as this comes out, I call you back?
Yeah, I'd love to come back and talk to you.
I mean, after I read it, of course.
Yeah,
after I read it.
Absolutely. Would love to be able to do that. Maybe my hair will be even longer by then. I hope so.
My envy will just grow. It'll be great. Yeah. Your hair, my envy.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic.
All right, Scott, you've been awesome. Thank you so much for your time. Much appreciated.
Thanks for what you do with this show. Thank you.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, leaders, educators, you see, there's no way you didn't relate to that. I highly recommend you delve into this concept and really learn more about leading from the middle. It's so important. It's so relevant to every role. And I've played a lot of roles in education. And so as one who's been around the block and kind of back again, you're just going to have to trust me on this. It's great stuff. And I'm so appreciative of Scott. So thank you, everyone, for your noble work. Be well.